For this April the 7th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Wednesday headlines. During remarks at the White House, President Biden opening the door for compromise on his more than $2 trillion infrastructure and jobs plan. He said, though, inaction is not an option. Meanwhile, the Treasury Department today releasing more details on that Democratic plan to hike corporate taxes over the next 15 years with a goal to raise money to pay for that $2 trillion price tag. And the Treasury Department saying that more than 156 million stimulus checks have been sent out this past month. All of this comes as the CDC is warning that UK COVID-19 variant is spreading across the U.S., appears to be more contagious and deadlier than some of the earlier strains of the virus. This particular strain has been reported in all 50 states. The U.S. is averaging more than 63,000 cases a day, an increase of more than 2% since last week. And a story we will be following tomorrow, with the White House expected to unveil its package of executive actions aimed at trying to curb gun violence. That from President Biden. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today, ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin, though, in Minneapolis. It is day 8 of the murder trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin. In what is expected to be the only outside expert to testify for the state about police training and the use of force, the LAPD Sergeant Jody Steiger back on the stand today. Sergeant Steiger saying that Derek Chauvin was using deadly force by pinning George Floyd on the ground at a time that was no force should have been used. He said the pressure of Chauvin's body weight could have caused asphyxia, which would then lead to his death. And even that being handcuffed and prone in that position made it harder for George Floyd to breathe. We'll get details just ahead. Attorney Anthony Frank is one of the prosecuting attorneys.
Do you have an opinion to a degree of reasonable professional certainty to how much force was reasonable for the defendant to use on Mr. Floyd after Mr. Floyd was handcuffed, placed in the prone position, and not resisting?
Yes.
And what is that opinion?
My opinion was that no force should have been used once he was in that position.
I see on this continuum that phrase deadly force. Is deadly force defined?
Yes.
Is it defined in Minneapolis Police Departmental policy?
Yes, it is.
At this time, I'd like to publish Exhibit 216. And if you could move to page 2, calling out the definition of deadly force. Sir, could you read into the record for the jury what the definition of deadly force is, beginning at force which the actor uses?
Yes. Force which the actor uses with the purpose of causing, or which the actor should reasonably know creates a substantial risk of causing death of great bodily harm.
I'd like to now republish Exhibit 254, the composite. And this is the force applied. I'm going to ask you, sir, do you have an opinion to a degree of reasonable professional certainty whether the force used, as shown in Exhibit 254, whether that force being applied then for the restraint period, which you've defined as 9 minutes and 29 seconds, would constitute deadly force?
Yes.
And what is that opinion?
That it would.
Why is that?
Because at the time of the restraint period, Mr. Floyd was not resisting. He was in the prone position. He was handcuffed. He was not attempting to evade. He was not attempting to resist. And the pressure that was being caused by the body weight could cause positional asphyxia, which could cause death.
That from today's courtroom testimony. The Minneapolis Star Tribune is reporting this evening that more than 24 of George Floyd's family members have converged on the city to watch the murder trial of the former police officer charged in his death. In addition, family members are bracing themselves, quote, for the difficult testimony and images expected in the coming days when his cause of death and the autopsy are examined. Now, yesterday, Sergeant Steiger was asked directly about former Officer Chauvin's actions in the arrest. He said he was blunt. My opinion was that the force was excessive. That's a quote from Sergeant Steiger. He is a former Marine who joined the LAPD in 1993. His duties include reviewing use of force incidents and complaints of officers' misconduct. One of Derek Chauvin's defense attorneys, Eric Nelson, had this line of questioning today.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, do you participate in a training or present a training or have anything to do with a training called Awful But Lawful or Lawful But Awful, something like that?
Yes.
And so you would agree the general concept is sometimes the use of force, it looks really bad, right?
Yes.
And sometimes it may be so, it may be caught on video, right? And it yes. looks bad, right?
Yes.
But it's still lawful.
Yes, based on that department's policies or based on that state's law. That was the whole premise. I did a presentation at a conference for that.
Okay. So the police use of force has a tendency at times to attract observers, right?
Yes.
And in the course of your career, I'm assuming at the very beginning of your career, not every single person was walking around with a video camera 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with it in their hand, right?
No, but in Los Angeles, it was right after Rodney King, so you did have people walking around with video cameras. There was actually one gentleman that actually was known for doing it.
Right. And so it's become, in the more recent history, as the smartphone has become as prevalent as it is, a more common experience. It's not just one guy driving around looking for cops arresting
Correct.
People. Any single person could be a potential videographer of a police interaction, right?
Yes, it's become pretty common practice.
Just some of the testimony earlier today by the LAPD Sergeant Jody Steiger inside that Minneapolis courtroom. Joe Barrett is monitoring the trial from Chicago. He is covering it for the Wall Street Journal. Let's begin with today's testimony. What are the headlines?
Well, really the most interesting thing that happened today, the defense was trying to get in this video clip from the body camera footage of George Floyd. And the defense lawyer, Eric Nelson, asked two different people whether they heard Mr. Floyd say, "I ate too many drugs." And the first person listened to the clip and couldn't agree to it. The second person did agree that he said, I ate too many drugs. But then the prosecution came back and said, actually, if you listen to the whole clip and you can hear the context where they're talking to him about drugs, would you say that Mr. Floyd said, I ain't do any drugs? And so it turns out that there's now competing arguments for what he actually said in this moment. And it goes to the heart of the case of whether it was use of force that led to his death or he took too many drugs and had a heart condition. So it was pretty revealing moment.
And that's the story at WSJ.com. So far, the prosecution really focusing on police training. We heard that today. We've been hearing it the last couple of days. What has stood out?
Well, you heard from the chief of police in Minneapolis. You heard it from an expert paid for by the prosecution. You heard it from a number of other people. These various experts are all saying that he used excessive force once Mr. Floyd was handcuffed, placed on his face on the ground, and stopped struggling. The force should have ended. Of course, the defense is going to try to say that there were other factors involved, but I mean that's what's the testimony we've been hearing so far.
We are a week and a half into this trial. What's next for the prosecution, and when will the defense make its case?
Well, the prosecution is now going through the investigators who looked into the case, and they've got their medical testimony up after that. And then sometime next week, it seems like the defense will get to make their case.
As you look at this case so far, what has stood out?
Well, you know, everybody's seen the video and everybody's got their opinion on it. It's really a question of whether you can believe your eyes from watching the video or some of these other arguments around, you know, what were his medical conditions? You know, did he swallow a fatal amount of drugs right as this incident started? It's really going to be up to the jury. It's sort of too close to call.
The headline at WSJ.com, the Derek Chauvin murder trial testimony focusing on police training, the reporting of Joe Barrett. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much.
In other news on this Wednesday, stating that debate is welcome, President Biden saying he remains open to compromise with Republicans on how to pay for his approximately $2 trillion jobs and infrastructure package. However, he insists that inaction is not acceptable. For example, the president saying that he is willing to agree to a lower corporate tax rate, his proposal calling for a 28% corporate tax rate up from 21%. Now, that may be politically necessary, writes TheHill.com. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a Democrat, earlier this week saying he supports raising the corporate rate from 21% to 25%, but not all the way to 28%. In remarks earlier today, President Biden outlining some of his objectives in the plan, including more dollars for America's VA hospitals.
Ask our wounded warriors and military families. To my Republican colleagues in Congress, shouldn't we modernize VA hospitals? Update them? Many of them are more than 50 years old. How about the estimate 450,000 post-9/11 veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, who, when they make that emergency call, or their husband, wife, son, daughter makes that call to the VA hospital, dad needs help, we have to bring him in. And they hear, you have to wait. We don't have room now. Come back, call me back in 8 days, 10 days, 12 days. Look at the more suicides in the military than people getting shot. Is it really your position, my friends, that our veterans don't deserve the most modern facilities that could catch that cancer diagnosis quicker, with access to better roads, cleaner water, high-speed internet that delivers information faster and more of it? Above all, infrastructure is about meeting the needs of a nation and putting Americans to work and being able to do and get paid for doing, having good jobs.
The president earlier today at the White House, the Eisenhower Executive Office building, and unlike the $1.9 trillion stimulus plan that passed back in March, the cost of which was almost entirely added to the growing national debt, the White House has said that to seek to pay for the infrastructure plan, they will do so, as mentioned earlier, by a tax hike on businesses and corporations. Now, the administration is pointing to a study by the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, which is a liberal think tank, finding that 55 corporations paid zero federal tax in 2020. Already, congressional Republicans have vowed to block a corporate tax hike. Gina Raimondo is the former Rhode Island governor and now the Commerce Secretary. She joined the president earlier today.
It is raised to 28%, though. That would put the U.S. at one of the highest in the world. Does it have to be 28%? Would you go lower? Could you accomplish the same thing if the tax rate weren't raised to 28%?
So there is room for compromise. That is clear. The president has said a few things. We have to get this investment done. He's charged us to work across the aisle and in a bipartisan way. And we need to pay for what we're doing. Like, our proposal is to invest in 8 years and pay back over 15. Now, we can have a discussion about that. Should we pay it back over 20 instead of 15? Is the rate not quite 28? Is it something, you know, lower? So we want a compromise. What we cannot do, and what I am imploring the business community not to do, is to say, we don't like 28, we're walking away, we're not discussing. That's unacceptable. Come to the table and problem solve with us to come up with a reasonable, responsible plan.
That's from the Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo earlier today. But Republicans are looking for ways to block another massive spending bill. Congressman Kevin Hern, appearing on a Tulsa radio station, charging that the president is being pushed too far to the left by Democrats in his party. This from KFAQ Talk Radio in Oklahoma.
Well, it's certainly going to be a reconciliation process. And with Schumer's newfound way to circumvent everything, it's really about being a socialist country where there's just one party making all the decisions on how the rest of us are going to live. And that's very concerning. You know, if you look at it, Casey, there's a lot of comments out there that Republicans don't care about infrastructure. That's just not true. If you look at history, history will tell you that every great nation has failed due to its lack of maintaining their infrastructure. You go back to the Chinese, to the Romans, to the British. So Republicans care. But all this is a Trojan horse for more taxes and spending. If you look at this bill, I mean, most of this bill, 60% of this bill is about new projects, projects that will never get off the ground for years because of the regulations that are currently in place and the more that and more regulations that the Biden administration wants to put on to builders, you know, whether it's the waters issue, the endangered species issues, all of those issues are going to stop these from being shovel ready. So this money is going to be available to be spent on whatever they want to spend it on. The reality is this bill has about 30% that's actually taking care of repairing our roads and bridges, which is what every American really thinks of infrastructure.
Right.
And the issue, the argument's always been, how do you pay for a narrow bill? I think we could figure that out. You know, one of the probably the most conservative ways to do this is you create a bonding program so that teachers unions and anybody, individuals, can buy these bonds. But these bonds wouldn't be sold until that project is ready to go. So you know that that money is targeted for fixing that project. So a very targeted ROI, and we get on down the road. We don't have to raise taxes. We don't have to do vehicle mileage tax. We don't have to change the income tax and kill jobs in America, which the Biden administration has been, and Joe Biden himself, has been really good at since the day he got elected canceling the Keystone Pipeline. So this is about really tax and spend, as you just mentioned. This is a way for them to go after corporations, go after individuals, go after hardworking Americans, and just crush them so that everybody who thinks they're the smartest people in the world will be in Washington, D.C., making these individual comments.
And that from Oklahoma Congressman Republican Kevin Hern on a day that the Treasury Department outlining details on that tax hike spread over the next 15 years. Meanwhile, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is walking back some of his comments that he made yesterday, warning corporations to stay out of politics, with a notable exception, they could still contribute to campaigns. Let's begin with what he said Tuesday.
Well, look, let me just give you an example. Let's take Major League Baseball, which is a pretty important corporation. If they applied the same standard they applied to Georgia, they couldn't have games in St. Louis because Missouri has a more restrictive voter law than the new Georgia law. What are they going to do about the Mets and the Yankees? New York has a more restrictive voter participation law than the new Georgia law. Where does it end? So my warning, if you will, to corporate America is to stay out of politics. It's not what you're designed for. And don't be intimidated by the left into taking up causes that put you right in the middle of one of America's greatest political debates. So that's my admonition. And Delta and the other Coca-Cola and the other companies that basically responded to this partisan appeal are doing the same thing. You know, Republicans drink Coca-Cola too. And we fly. And we like baseball.
A reference to Delta Airlines, that yesterday from Senator Mitch McConnell. Well, today at a news conference, the Kentucky senator clarifying some of his criticism, saying it was far more broad than he intended, and he related more specifically to the Georgia voting law with corporations based in that state like Delta and Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I didn't say that very artfully yesterday. They're certainly entitled to be involved in politics. They are. My principal complaint is they didn't read the darn bill. The President of the United States called the bill a Jim Crow exercise to suppress voter turnout, presumably based on race, because that's what the Jim Crow allegation is. That bastion of conservatism, the Washington Post, gave the president 4 Pinocchios for lying about it.
And those comments today by the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. And you're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Wednesday. Here are some of your other headlines. The White House saying as of now, the U.S. is not considering a boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. There have been calls for American athletes to skip the games as a way to protest allegations of China's human rights violations. Former Vice President Mike Pence writing an autobiography set for release in 2023. Simon & Schuster announcing the two-book deal in a statement saying, quote, "The currently untitled book is the story of Pence's faith in public service, covering his trajectory from Indiana to his time as the second highest-ranking official in the Trump administration." And in Los Angeles, the sheriff's office confirming that excessive speed was the cause of Tiger Woods' crash. He was going about 40 miles over the speed limit when he hit a tree and was badly injured. And now to the latest on COVID-19. The variant first identified in the UK is now the most common strain of coronavirus here in the U.S. That warning today from CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. And according to data from Johns Hopkins University, five states account for nearly half of the country's new COVID-19 cases this past week. Those states, New York, Michigan, Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Hospitalizations have also climbed to about 5,000 a day. Health officials say they're seeing more and more younger adults, those in their 30s and 40s. Joining Dr. Walensky for today's White House COVID briefing, Senior Advisor Andy Slavitt.
I think you said that the UK variant is now the most common lineage in the U.S. Do you mean it's the most common variant or it's the most common period, like even compared with the original strain? And then I think this question probably is best for you, Andy. Sorry, just one quick. Yesterday, the president said we're not at the finish line yet. But can you kind of clarify or qualify what does the finish line look like? What should people be looking for to know that we are approaching that? Since we know we're not at it now, what does that look like?
So I'll start. Caitlin, thank you for that. It is the most common lineage, period. So there are many different lineages of the many different potential variants. There are several different kinds of sort of wild type variants. And this is, in fact, the most common lineage right now.
I think your second question, let me begin on, and then I would invite both Drs. Walensky and Fauci to comment. You know, we are at about 3/4 of seniors that have had their first dose. We think that can go higher. And as the president did yesterday, we urge seniors and people who are in contact with seniors to help them get vaccinated right now. We are in, you know, between 40 and 45% of adults in the U.S. that have had their first vaccine, which means sometime likely this month, over the next couple of weeks, we're going to get to about half. What's important to remember for those who are getting vaccinated is that that still means that we've got half of the adult population that will not have had their vaccine yet. And so while it is very tempting as we each get vaccinated to think about the things we can now do, we need to remember that when we're at our best as a country, we bring everyone along. We don't just bring ourselves along as we get over the line, but we bring the whole country with us. And so we've got to continue to do this together. You know, as for a quote-unquote finish line, you know, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the correct metaphor for what we're going to experience. I think Dr. Walensky, I would offer, has been, you know, leading commentary through kind of gradual steps along the dial that we can do as a country to get back to our old lives. And that began weeks ago with conversations around what I kind of refer to as the hugging guidance.
Those remarks earlier today from Andy Slavitt of the Biden administration and CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. And joining us on the phone is Peter Sullivan. He is following this story for The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. Just how worrisome is this new UK variant?
Hi, thanks for having me. Well, it's definitely a concern. It is rising. The CDC director today said it's now the most common strain in the United States. And it is more transmissible. It's more contagious. It's easier for you to get it. And there's some evidence that it actually causes somewhat more severe disease. You're more likely to have a severe outcome with this new strain. So it is a concern. I mean, it's not a reason to panic. The vaccines still work on it. So it's still a reason to get vaccinated. That's still important. And ultimately, that's going to be the way to control this, is to get more people vaccinated.
But as you report, it's also spreading more easily. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, it just has to do with the science of this new strain, the makeup of the strain. I mean, I think that's still being studied, but what we've seen so far, it does spread more easily. And that's actually, in some ways, more of a concern than causing more severe illness, because if it's spreading more easily, then it's just expanding the group of people who have it, and therefore if you take X percent of that are going to be in the hospital, that's a bigger group. So that is why it's concerning.
Is there also a concern because as more Americans get vaccinated, and you've seen the polling numbers, people feeling, look, I can move on, business as usual, life is returning to normal?
Yeah, that definitely is a concern. There's, you know, the weather is getting nicer, at least in parts of the country. And people are, you know, understandably are tired of COVID. You know, they're tired of staying home. They're tired of precautions. So that's a broad concern, is that, you know, and we're seeing governors, even many Democratic governors, are lifting capacity limits on restaurants and that sort of thing. So, yeah, the experts realize people are restless, but the message is kind of hang in there a little while longer. Let's let you know, the rest of the population have access to the vaccines, hang in for another month or so, and then we'll probably be in a much better place because of the vaccinations.
This is the headline. The UK coronavirus variant now is a more common strain here in the U.S. The reporting of Peter Sullivan. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, modest gains for the Dow, up 16 points. The S&P rose 6. The Nasdaq, though, losing 9.5. Former President Trump saying today in a statement that Congressman Matt Gaetz never asked me for a pardon, disputing a New York Times report that Congressman Gaetz asked the former president for a blanket pardon as the president's term in office was coming to a close. It was earlier this week that the Times reported that Congressman Gaetz sought that preemptive pardon for himself. The request, though, was never seriously considered by the White House because administration officials decided that preemptive pardons were off the table. All of this comes as the Florida congressman, facing a Department of Justice investigation, which we should point out began while President Trump was still in office, over an alleged sexual relationship with a 17-year-old, as well as related accusations of sex trafficking law violations. In New York politics, Andrew Giuliani, former Trump White House staffer, the son of the former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, telling the Washington Examiner that he plans to run for governor next year in New York. Despite a growing number of sexual misconduct allegations and a federal investigation into his handling of COVID-19 in nursing homes, Governor Andrew Cuomo is still expected to run for re-election next year. Axios.com writing that a Cuomo-Giuliani matchup would set up a clash between two of New York's most prominent political families. And during a news conference in Albany, Governor Cuomo saying that people who came to meet with him in his office during the pandemic would be tested for COVID-19. Including his family members. But he insists he was not involved in the details of that testing.
Hey, Governor.
Hey, Peter, remember me? Tall, good-looking, blonde hair, blue eyes, button nose.
Long time no see.
Yeah.
Was it appropriate for your family and friends to be tested for COVID when others could not? Were you involved in this? Were you aware of it?
Peter, the assembly is looking at testing issue, and I don't want to get ahead of them. But I was not involved in the testing program to that intimate level. People who I would meet with and I would be in exposure with, I was aware they were being tested. So if you came to see me in my office, you would be tested, and that applied with my family also. But the assembly is doing a review on that, and I would let them do it.
A news conference with Governor Cuomo in Albany, by the way, a former staffer who accused the New York governor of groping her in the mansion, detailing her allegations today in a new interview in the Albany Times-Union. It's available on the website. Stephanie Benton outlining her account from last November, in which she said the governor not only made inappropriate comments, but also claims that he tried to grope her. She is one of 10 women claiming charges of sexual misconduct by the New York governor. 3 months after the protests and violence broke out inside the U.S. Capitol, officials are looking at all aspects of security. In a study conducted by National Public Radio, of the more than 300 people at the Capitol that have been arrested, about 15% had former military ties. It is an issue the Pentagon is looking into. Here is the Assistant Defense Secretary, retired Navy Admiral John Kirby.
Your other question gets at something that I think the Secretary wants to get his hands around, too, which is a better sense of the data. And I can't, you know, we don't have all that data right now. But we are working more closely now with law enforcement to try to get a better sense of the sorts of investigations they're doing of people affiliated with the military and being investigated for criminal behavior associated with extremist ideology. And I say that very clearly. Military affiliate doesn't mean necessarily somebody on active duty in the reserve capacity. Most of them happen to be veterans. And obviously, we don't have purview over veterans. And as for your other question about data surrounding separations, that is certainly something that the Secretary is interested in trying to pursue in terms of a better data collection. But as you pointed out in your question, Nick, sometimes individuals are administratively punished below the level of a court-martial for activity that violates the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And there's never been a central database of that here at the department. That is something that is done at local level, local command levels, and usually on a regional basis, not something that would be looked at here. The other thing, and I've said this before, is that even for criminal behavior that does rise to the level of court-martial, it's not like it's always evident what motivated that behavior. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. So it's very hard for us to be able to spit out data for you that's very specific with respect to disciplinary actions over behavior that is inspired by extremist ideology. But again, that's part of this exercise, is to figure out what we don't know, figure out what we can know, and how do we go about knowing it. And that's, again, I think, all going to be wrapped up into the discussions with the Secretary, and I'm sure will help inform whatever decisions and policies he wants to pursue going forward.
And on that overall criticism that the military has talked about this in the past, said it was going to tackle the problem, but never actually did.
Speak for what was done in the past, Nick. All I can do is speak for Secretary Austin and what we're trying to do right now. And the stand down now has ended. He does expect to get a readout from the services here before the end of the week, and then we'll move forward. And we'll keep you as informed as we can as we move forward. What I can tell you now is he's taking it very seriously.
That update from John Kirby, the Assistant Defense Secretary and Chief Spokesperson at the Pentagon. Meanwhile, dozens of former senior national security advisors, military and elected officials from both sides of the aisle, urging lawmakers in Congress to establish an independent bipartisan commission to investigate the attack on January the 6th. The letter includes a warning that the threat from homegrown terrorism is growing and that the people who died on January 6th, including a Capitol Hill police officer, needs to be prevented. One of those who signed the letter, the country's first Homeland Security Secretary, Tom Ridge. We spoke with him late this afternoon.
Well, first of all, it's not only the opinion of the 60 or 70 national security, military, diplomatic, and elected officials on this. The FBI director testified recently on the Hill that January 6th was not an isolated event. I mean, between external influences, probably potentially even foreign disinformation, white supremacist violent extremism, and the like, this is a manifestation of a turbulence and of conditions below the surface that reared its ugly head on January 6th, but it's certainly not an isolated event. And unless we understand completely causation, and there are many, many potential causes related to this tsunami of an event, we'll never be able to be in a position as a country to prevent it from ever happening again.
The letter talks about immediate security failings on Capitol Hill. Why are there failings? What needs to be done?
Well, it just seems to us, and again, until you get, and again, we're calling for a bipartisan independent commission. But it seems from those, some of us looking at this from afar, admittedly not granular, but from maybe 30,000 feet, there had to be some intelligence failures along the line. I personally know of some nonpartisan, apolitical, nonprofit groups that monitor the dark web that saw indications of potential violence in the nation's capital long before January 6th. So I think, was it an intelligence failure? Perhaps. Was there lack of preparation on the Hill vis-a-vis not just the Capitol Police, but maybe the coordination with DOD? Apparently was somewhat problematic. Again, we need to revisit the horrific events of the 6th, to understand what happened, why it happened, and then ensure ourselves that it doesn't happen again by making very specific recommendations. Steve, I think of the 9/11 Commission. There you had criminal investigations. Congress working together, and you had an independent commission. Today we need Congress, Department of Justice, and this independent commission, hopefully to complement each other and come up with some significant recommendations to ensure that it does not happen ever again.
We're talking with former Pennsylvania Governor and former Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge. You also served in the House of Representatives in the 1980s and early 1990s. Is Congress taking this seriously enough?
Yes. Well, number one, I believe they are. And if they need any reminder whatsoever, and it's been a couple months before I've gone up to the Hill, but I remember in the 80s and 90s, my access from the Longworth House office building to the nation's capital was unfettered. You saw some Capitol police from there, maybe occasional barricade. But right now, it looks like Fortress America. And I would say, not just as a former legislator or public servant, but as a citizen of this country, when I think about what's happened and when I visit the nation's capital, particularly up on the Hill, where I was privileged to serve for 12 years, my emotions run the gamut from depression to anger to sadness that we've let the situation internally with domestic threats get so out of control that we've reduced to protecting the most fundamental institution of our government, the legislative branch. And so I'm hopeful that an independent commission working with justice and working with Congress can not only find out and really do a thorough job to understand and appreciate all the factors, all the influences. There were many currents of unfortunately activity, and it resulted in that tsunami of January 6th. We need to understand it and make sure it never happens again.
The call for a bipartisan January 6th commission among those signing the letter, former governor, former Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, joining us from Pennsylvania. Governor, thank you for being with us.
It was a great pleasure to be with you. Be well. Thank you.
And a reminder, this program, Washington Today, it is available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And, of course, all of our coverage available online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully for the Wednesday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.